If you speak the truth, have a foot in the stirrup.
Hello, and welcome to another installment of the Sea Realm Podcast. I'm your host, KMO, and this is episode number 532, Election 2018, prepared for release onto the World Wide Web on Tuesday, November 6th, 2018. While I am recording this on Election Day, I'm not reading polls, I'm not really watching races very closely. The only ones I particularly care about are the ones that are local and close to me. I did interview the lieutenant governor of my state of Vermont on Sunday of this week, and I will play that interview for you here in just a few moments, although there's something rather ironic that I want to relay, and that is this. There's a YouTuber I follow. He goes by the handle StixHexenhammer666. He is a former Satanist. He is an occultist, and he also watches politics. He's basically a libertarian, but right now he's particularly down on the Democrats, as am I, even though I voted for several of them today. But he's a pretty successful YouTuber. He has hundreds of thousands of subscribers. He's actually going to be doing live election coverage tonight for InfoWars. And what's funny is that in a state like Vermont, where there are fewer than 750,000 people in the whole state, I can get the lieutenant governor on the phone pretty easily. I couldn't possibly, well, maybe I won't say possibly, but I have tried to communicate with StixHexenhammer666, and he's a lot more popular than the lieutenant governor of Vermont and much harder to get in touch with. Oh, and one detail that I left out there, and which makes the whole story a bit more relevant and coherent, I think, is that StixHexenhammer is himself a Vermonter. And he is probably better known than almost any politician in Vermont, with the exception of our two senators, Bernie Sanders and Patrick Leahy. All right, the first thing that I'm going to share with you in this episode of the podcast is a conversation that I recorded this morning with my friend Rob. And I won't mention Rob's last name because he's not a public figure, although listeners to the Sea Realm Vault podcast will probably recognize Rob's voice and his intellect, because Rob reads a lot of books, far more books than I do. So I like to, every now and again, just set down a microphone in front of him and have him tell me about the book that he has read most recently. So he's not going to be delivering a book report here in the Sea Realm podcast, but he will on the next episode of the Sea Realm Vault podcast. That's really the conversation we recorded today, but to start off with, we just talked in very general terms about politics. So here is my friend Rob.
You're listening to the Sea Realm Podcast. C stands for consciousness.
All right, it is Election Day 2018, November, what is it, 6th?
6th.
You voted? I voted?
Yes.
I'm here with Rob, and in a minute we're going to talk about automating inequality, how high-tech tools profile, police, and punish the poor by your Virginia Eubanks. That'll be for the Sea Realm Vault podcast. But just for the next couple of minutes, let's just spitball on the topic of politics.
Okay. All right.
So you had a decision to make whether to vote in Vermont or New Hampshire.
Yes,
and you chose Vermont. Why?
Yeah, I just moved from New Hampshire to Vermont. Just about a month ago.
But you had just moved from Vermont to New Hampshire.
Three years ago. But I didn't have to change my residency for 60 days when I moved to Vermont. So I could still be a New Hampshire resident on paper and still be registered to vote there and vote. And I thought about it, which way am I going to go to vote? And I think I may have made the wrong decision. I registered to vote in Vermont and declared my residency. Mm-hmm. Because in Vermont, well, okay, New Hampshire, I thought my vote might be a little more powerful because I disagree with a lot of things that are happening there, so I would be voting for some change, and maybe that would be effective. I don't know. Maybe. Probably not. But in Vermont, I generally agree with most of the politicians. So even if the person I don't vote for in Vermont does not win the election, the person who takes over that position is probably not going to be really averse to my political agenda. So I don't know.
And you mentioned before that you even don't mind our Vermont governor, who's a Republican, Phil Scott.
Yeah, normally I'm independent or Democratic in my preferences, but I don't see any disasters that he's made happen. I was very proud of him for signing the gun control legislation on the bump stocks. I thought that was very responsible of him, going against his own party.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
I was not too pleased with him in that he dragged his feet intentionally on legalizing marijuana by basically taking a bill that the legislature had sent to him and holding on to it until just a couple minutes, really, mm-hmm. before it would have gone into law without his signature, and then vetoing it.
Yeah.
Knowing full well that delaying so long and then vetoing would prevent the legislature from getting back to him with an amended bill in time for him to mm-hmm. sign it that year. So
I can see that being a problem. I have to say, though, when he had a negative stance toward the legalization, he actually made some logical arguments. It wasn't like, oh, it's evil, it's unchristian, or only drug addicts are using it.
Those arguments wouldn't fly in Vermont.
I know.
But what he's saying now is that he won't allow for the commercial distribution. I mean, right now you can't get busted for having it, but you can get busted for buying or selling it. So he says he won't allow for any commercial distribution until they have a roadside test that determines whether or not somebody is impaired. And no such test is forthcoming. That's not anywhere on the near horizon.
Exactly.
So that's basically his excuse mm-hmm. for holding on to, you know, the de facto
right.
prohibition on marijuana.
Oh, yeah.
And for me, that is a dodge. That is mm-hmm. that is no more logical or rational or defensible than saying it is the demon weed with the roots in hell.
Okay.
It's just the thing that flies in the 21st century that hasn't been thoroughly discredited yet.
Right.
But that's because most people don't understand what testing for marijuana does. You're testing for metabolites, which are stored in your fat cells. And, you know, the result that one gets when you test your blood or your urine, it does not indicate, you know, whether you are impaired at the moment.
Sure. You could have smoked a week ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You could smoke. And here's another thing. I mean, I know lots of people who smoke every day. Some of them get up in the morning and smoke. And, you know, they take their lunch break at work and they go smoke. And, you know, they smoke before they drive home. That's just their default state. And they can drive as well high as they can not high. Maybe better, because not high they'll be distracted.
Yes, somebody I lived with had that lifestyle.
And you probably didn't fear to get into a car with them, did you?
I generally had fears of that person's driving ability, but I don't think it was related to marijuana.
Okay, fair enough.
So yes and no.
So anyway, that's a topic I can rant on at length, so
sure.
I'll stop.
Okay, all right.
What was on the ballot that was important to you?
I think we got a lot of people talking about healthcare, and it's really important. And it's something I care deeply about. So I can't say that I was went into the platforms in high detail like you have,
mm-hmm.
but we'll see what happens.
How'd you go for governor?
Christine.
So for those who don't live in Vermont, what would you say about Christine? How would you describe?
An interesting character.
Yeah.
An interesting character who is very brave.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, to put himself, herself out there in the public sphere like that.
Right. So what is this himself, herself stuff?
Is it transgender?
Mm-hmm.
I think it's the only transgender candidate for governor, certainly, in the country. A person who has a lot of business experience and seems to be on the progressive side of the agenda. So...
And if she wins, we might well have retail marijuana stores in a couple of years.
Yeah, no matter what Scott said or did, this is still Vermont.
Yeah. Well, he has very effectively dragged his heels. And, you know, if you can delay reform, then the people who profit from a corrupt system get to profit longer.
Sure, or they can set up a system where they profit more
mm-hmm.
after persuading the politicians they have in their pockets to create the system for them.
Right.
Yeah.
So this is something that I talked about with our current lieutenant governor, David Zuckerman. He was on the radio show on Sunday, and I'm going to play that interview on this podcast in a bit. But now let's switch gears and talk about automating inequality, how high-tech tools profile, police, and punish the poor by Virginia Eubanks.
Yes. A very interesting book. Virginia Eubanks is a professor of political science, so...
Next up on the podcast is a conversation from this past Sunday's Sea Realm radio show. I had a live call-in guest, and he was David Zuckerman, the current lieutenant governor of the state of Vermont and someone who is seeking re-election. I very much hope that he wins re-election because he's, as I say at the end of the interview, he really shares my values. He cares about the things I care about. He's somebody that I want to have a voice in state government. But I thought that he was going to be calling in toward the end of the show, and he actually called in at the very beginning, so I was kind of taken off guard. We've got a little small talk up front, which got truncated just because the software that we use to record, you know, to archive local shows at the radio station isn't quite synced up in terms of, you know, when it starts and stops with the start and stop times of the actual show. So we lost the first few minutes of conversation, but really the first couple of minutes of the conversation is expendable. It was small talk. So here's my conversation with Lieutenant Governor David Zuckerman, minus the first couple of minutes. Again, that's all an aside. Let me just say that you are currently our Lieutenant Governor, and you are going to be running, you are running, have been running diligently, I expect, for re-election. And sure, that election day is fast approaching. So you've been talking to a lot of people in our state. What are the main concerns that people have been expressing to you?
Well, there's a range of things. A number of people are just really focused on the national situation. Frankly, in some respects, that's overwhelming all of the state races in terms of just our democracy, how our country is being run. Not even entirely about whether people agree or disagree with the positions that are coming out of Washington, although the majority of Vermonters are not sympathetic to the outcomes right now. But beyond that, what are the fundamental values of humanity and decency and leadership coming out of the president, or lack thereof, with respect to being a president of all the people versus sort of a demagogue rallying a large but minority of this country? That's one topic that comes up a lot. Another topic that comes up is much more focused on Vermont, and there's a couple different aspects to it. That the broad word that our governor uses of affordability is very accurate and true for a lot of folks. People are really struggling when it comes to issues like healthcare and the trouble people are having either paying their healthcare premiums or certainly paying their bills if they come into a healthcare circumstance. The issue of pay at the workplace, and a lot of folks, the vast majority, are supportive of raising the minimum wage. For instance, 50 cents an hour puts $1,000 a year into people's pockets. So when people are struggling with, quote, affordability, let's talk about what wages people are making. There's a lot of single parents working at convenience stores and others who are trying to fend for their families, and they're making a minimum wage that doesn't pay the bills. So it's about economics, and it's fundamentally about economics for working class people, while the wealthy are just getting richer and richer.
So inequality, then, is certainly a big issue for you.
Well, absolutely. I've just been at some rallies with Bernie, and he talks about the fact that literally three people, I count them on your hand, have more wealth than the bottom 50% of the people, about 150, 160 million people in this country. Now, there are those out there that would say, well, they've earned it because they were really smart to create a pyramid Ponzi scheme and then basically own the country through political donations. I would argue that, and Vermonters, I think, in general, would argue that everybody is part of what makes the wealth of this country exist through their hard work in their various jobs, and that right now the system is set up so that wealth is concentrated in the hands of those few. Wealth inequality is a huge issue for struggling Vermonters, and I would add that when you look at Vermont, we're actually no different than rural red parts of this country, all over this country, that are hemorrhaging young people, losing people in the communities, working low-wage jobs. It's true whether it's red or blue areas anywhere in this country, particularly rural ones. And Vermont is a rural state. So a lot of the discussions around building a rural economy, not based on one or two mega corporations, but how do we build it up at the community level? Those are the things people are talking about.
You say that Vermont is a rural state, and last we spoke, you were a working farmer. Is that still the case?
I am still working on the farm, and had pig chores this morning, and had a rough year. You guys had more rain. I don't know if you're far enough south to have the, oh my goodness, way too much rain that way south had, but we had quite a drought up in my part of the state, and it was not a great season for us.
Well, I've been an avid gardener in the past, but right now I live in an apartment, so I'm largely insulated from the vicissitudes of the weather.
Fair enough.
But climate change, I think, is certainly a big issue for most people on the left, and even, I would say, a fair number of people on the right, even though the right-wing party doesn't represent that issue.
That's right. Yep, it's huge. We are seeing very different weather in Vermont than I think people who grew up here and people that are 50, 60, 70 years old really remember. We don't have, although the last couple weeks we have, sort of gray, rainy days. We often have these intense rainstorms or intense dry periods. We clearly don't have the cold and snow and winter that we used to have, which was obviously also a piece of our economy. I'm concerned about 20, 40 years from now, what's going to happen to the maple industry? You know, what's going to happen to the ski industry? Climate change affects Vermont in so many ways. Which is why I find it sort of strange that some in Vermont say, well, we can't do anything about it, so let's not do anything about it. Whereas I think the majority of Vermonters say, wait a minute, we need to build a vision for Vermont that includes a fossil fuel independent future out in the future. It's called a vision. It doesn't mean tomorrow or the next day, but it does mean putting policies into place and taking personal responsibility for our individual impacts. And we've got to be moving away from that. We can actually build jobs that way, be creative with this process, and draw people to this state who recognize that Vermont wants to be a leader on a carbon-free or at least greatly carbon-reduced future where folks take care of each other and think about more than just themselves. And frankly, when we do that, we're all better off. Sometimes the discussion is a zero-sum game. If you do this over there, then you're going to lose something over here. The reality is if we work together, everybody, or at least the vast majority of people, can benefit. And that's one of the hard parts about political rhetoric these days is which way do you look at that situation? Is it some are going to win and some are going to lose? Or if we work together, can we make it so the vast majority of us are better off?
Vermont is, in the current parlance, a pretty solidly blue state. Is working, you know, bipartisan cooperation as big an issue here as it is, say, in California?
You know, I think it's much better here than it is in a lot of other places. Sometimes you hear rhetoric out of Montpelier, and sometimes you hear the majority of news stories, which are about those unique and big battles that are had. When you actually get down into the committee level, 90-plus percent of the bills are voted out unanimously. Even some difficult topics get voted out unanimously. For instance, the budget this last year, the Appropriations Committee with four Republicans all voted in the House, all voted for the budget. In the Senate, it was unanimous across party lines at one point. It got partisan after the governor vetoed the bill, and then the Republicans, particularly in the House, actually, drew partisan lines and said, oh, we voted for the budget, but now we're not going to. So we're seeing it creep into Vermont. But when you really look at the system as it works day to day, the party labels tend to fade away, and we tend to value each legislator for their skills and knowledge and experience. Even in the Senate, when we started this biennium, we had seven Republicans out of 30 people, and two of those Republicans were chairs on committees, and I believe one or two were vice chairs. And so there's been a real effort in Vermont for the whole time I've ever served, except for a few years when Walter Fried was Speaker in the House, that we've always had Republican chairs in the House and the Senate. And that, to me, says something really valuable about how we all treat each other's experience and knowledge and skill set and what everybody can bring to the table when we actually sit down at a table together and talk about issues in more depth. When we get into the soundbite world, that's when it breaks down, and unfortunately I think that's a lot of what happens in Washington, D.C.
Well, I certainly agree with that, not just in Washington, D.C., but in the mainstream corporate media as well. The soundbite is the ruler.
Yeah, it's true. They don't have these kinds of conversations as much, and I thank you for having it.
Well, it is my pleasure. I don't expect you to remember because I know you speak to a lot of people, but you and I did did speak before for this program. Yeah. I think it was back in 2016 before you were elected.
That's right.
Well, you were already serving, but you had not yet been elected lieutenant governor. And right. We talked primarily about drug policy reform and the push to legalize marijuana, you know, the responsible adult use of marijuana. in Vermont, and that is now a done deal. But there is the – it seems like an unresolved issue, and I just leave it up to you. Go ahead.
Well, absolutely. You know, over the last few years, I think a lot of the propaganda has been broken down. I think a lot of the folks that have been consuming illegally but under the radar screen have now made it apparent to some of their legislators that sometimes folks have a beer, sometimes adults responsibly consume cannabis. And over time, the legislators are starting to recognize that. I even had some legislators since we passed the law say that they've had people they never expected come up to them and say, well, now that it's legal, where do I get it? And they said, well, I didn't believe that statistic that 80,000 Vermonters might consume each month. But now I'm starting to see that there's a lot of people that do. And so, and did, I should say, not just do, but did before we passed the law. So now what we're facing is a discussion around should only those who, well, you just talked about, you live in an apartment. If you live in an apartment and your landlord says you can't grow any, how are you supposed to get it? Right now we have a system that says if you have a connection of a friend who grows and will give you some, or if you have land and you can grow your own, or you own your home and you can grow your own and you happen to know how to grow it, you can have it. But if you don't have those things, you're out of luck. You still have to either go in the underground market, and that's illegal, or go without. And what I've argued for is a statewide legal and regulated system, potentially with a couple different tiers. One which would be a small-scale grower co-op model, where those folks who have already been producing for their local community and know their consumers and maybe consume some of it themselves would have one type of license, which would be less regulatory. There would need to be oversight, but less regulatory and a standard retail tax on that. But then there might be a whole other set of licenses, also small scale, for those that are going to produce for the wholesale market into the retail stores. That would be a little bit more regulatory. That would have, because again, you wouldn't have the direct connection between the consumer and the producer anymore. You would have a wholesale tax to the retail level and then a retail tax out to the consumers, whether they be tourists or folks that live in denser populated areas that don't have access to a local co-op grower. But keeping it all small scale. You know, Vermont has this great reputation. We've already got it with beer. We've got it with maple syrup. We've got it with so many different crafts that we produce on a smaller scale, higher quality. We can do that again with cannabis, boost our tourism economy. It's been estimated by a joint fiscal office that this is a $350 to $400 million economy just within the first couple of years. And that includes things like accountants and electricians and plumbers, as well as the tourism part of the economy. All of that, since the beer industry right now is considered about a $700 million industry, and it's been going for about 10 or 15 years, even longer in some instances, I think we can do that again with cannabis and really help boost our rural economy, especially in southern Vermont, where you're closer to a lot of the population centers of southern New England, New York, New Jersey.
Is your view a mainstream view in Montpelier? And if not, what is?
Well, I think my view is a mainstream view outside Montpelier. It is not yet a majority viewpoint in all of Montpelier. In the House, there's a little bit of a struggle with some of the more moderate Democrats, including some in leadership. And there's some support from the majority of the Democrats and from some of the Republicans. In the Senate, it's actually pretty broad support. We've got well over two-thirds majority in the Senate, including some Republicans. But the real roadblock is the governor. He's put up the, well, we can't do this until we have a roadside test argument, knowing that that argument means putting this off for 6 to 10 years, because the only roadside tests are for blood or saliva, which also means giving up your right to privacy with your genetic material. And frankly, it isn't the same as alcohol, where there's a strict number that if you're above that number, you're unsafe to drive. And if you're below that number, you're safe to drive. With each person, it's different because it stores up in your system, even if you're not being inebriated by it. The other piece is that the Highway Transportation Safety Authority, the national highway safety people themselves, have done studies and shows very clearly that alcohol makes you drive much more aggressively, much faster, and veer out of your lane and into oncoming traffic or off the road much more frequently. Cannabis also inebriates you, but in a very different way. It typically makes you a slower driver, which does not necessarily mean safer, by the way. But it also says you weave more back and forth while at the same time staying in the lane more and not weaving out of the lane into oncoming traffic. Either way, there are concerns. People should not be driving under the influence of anything, whether it's cannabis, alcohol, or frankly, exhaustion. If, like me, you farm for 12 hours on a hot, sunny day in the summer, and then you go to a meeting at 7 at night, and you're coming home at 10 at night, there's safety issues there. So we need to make sure we talk about highway safety, not as to why one is is driving unsafely, but more that one is driving unsafely, but more that one is driving unsafely. But that's going to be a roadblock, to use a sort of a pun there, on moving this law forward as long as Governor Scott is in office, unless enough people either vote him out of office or even those that support him say, Governor Scott, you've got to let this become law and move it forward on our ability to bring this above board, have money for youth prevention, have money for opiate addiction, have money for highway safety with more drug recognition experts on the roads. And, you know, that's up to voters. I think right now the majority of Vermonters support it, but they've got to be more vocal about it.
Well, it's an issue that's of importance to me personally, but I have to admit that the issue of opiates is much more pressing. So I'd like to invite
Absolutely.
You to talk about that.
Absolutely. And this could help fund some of that scenario.
What more can you say, though, on the topic of opiate addiction and Vermont, and maybe even wrap that in with some criminal justice reform?
Well, sure. A couple different things. I really applaud our Attorney General, T.J. Donovan, for looking a lot at the different ways we have really made errors in our criminal justice system. We've got to look at addiction and substance use disorders as what they are. They do not inherently make someone a criminal. Having an addiction that is crippling in its grip on you to then make you need to buy these drugs, then you run out of money, and then one goes to thievery and stealing, which is a criminal activity. But if we could do a couple different things. One, I know the Attorney General is now part of the lawsuit against Purdue Pharma, which is one of the biggest promoters of opiates and the opiate-based pain medications that has been the absolutely clear gateway and primary reason people are addicted to opiates. So that work that he's doing is important. We have to continue to review our laws about why people are put into prison. For the most part, with cannabis, we've alleviated that. But even still, if you're out on parole for a different crime, many are violating that with cannabis and going back into jail. That's not exactly helping our society, to be perfectly honest. And if we had more of those beds available, we could bring back people from out of state, which would also both save Vermont money and also help us work towards job training and programs to make sure that when those folks are released from prison, they actually come out ready to be members of society again, rather than come out hardened as criminals, ready to do, unfortunately, more problematic things to go back into jail. But the drug addiction problem is very real. It's very serious. And we don't have the economic resources to do what we need to do to basically both prevent people from getting addicted in the first place, and secondly, help people with the appropriate treatment so that they can become productive members of society again and stop going down the path of destitution, no money, and thievery to then feed what is, at that point, an addiction, which for those of us that don't have them, it's very hard for many to understand that once addicted, it is not a choice any longer. It is a grip that people cannot get out from under, and it's done through drugs that primarily are prescribed. I had an employee once who ultimately was, unfortunately, addicted to opiates. I didn't know it, and he had gotten there because his hand had been injured. He'd been given opiate pain medication and unfortunately took enough of them over time to relieve the pain that his body became dependent on it as an addiction. That is not something that makes that person a criminal. And we've got to make sure we find alternative pain medications, of which actually cannabis is one of them, as well as other methods to make sure we don't drive more people to addiction through prescription drugs.
Well, we're just about out of time, but I would like to invite you to close by saying whatever you feel comfortable saying about the governor's race.
Well, I strongly support Christine Hallquist. Phil Scott is certainly a very nice guy. I respect him tremendously. He's been a wonderful public servant. But when it comes to depth on the issues, having a vision for the state of Vermont that is working towards clean water, that is working towards affordability with respect to jobs that frankly pay people enough to live in this state, who's looking at getting broadband out into the rural areas of our state. I know down your way, you get off of the main lines, there's not a lot of broadband or cell capacity. If we want to expand jobs in this state, we've got to get that expanded into the southern part of the state, because people could live and work down there in this incredibly safe environment that we have with these incredibly good rural schools that we have. And we could draw people from southern New England or keep people in Vermont with decent paying jobs who would then repopulate our rural counties and our rural areas. That would help with everything from our rural fire squads, having more people living and staying in the community while working. It would help bolster our numbers in our schools, which would give kids more opportunities. It's just really a stark difference between these two candidates for governor. And I think Christine can bring a great vision to Vermont. Will I be able to work with whoever is elected? Absolutely. I've tried to work well with the current governor. If he's reelected, I think we could do some things together, particularly if he sort of moves away from some of the advice of his contemporary soundbite producing staff people and actually goes back to who he is, which is a cooperative person with the legislature, with my office. But that's really up to the governor. He gets to make that choice, because whoever's governor is a step above me. I don't get to tell them what to do. So we'll see what happens.
Well, Lieutenant Governor David Zuckerman, your values are very much in line with mine, and I wish you great success. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you for the time, and I appreciate being on the show.
Stay well.
Yep.
All righty. That was our current and hopefully continuing Lieutenant Governor David Zuckerman. You can check out his website. I have it up here. It is called Zuckerman4VT.com. And there's he has position statements there on issues that we did not talk about, although I think we hit the big ones. Affordability, moving toward a post-carbon future, realizing that this is a long-term vision and not something that is accomplished overnight. And, you know, from my perspective, criminal justice reform is huge. You know, David talked about how somebody who is out on parole, if they smoke a joint, they are now dirty. Their system, that marijuana can be detected in their system for weeks. And if they are, you know, surprised with a urinalysis test, which does happen to people out on parole, they're going back to prison. But what you might not realize is that drinking a beer on parole can send you back to prison. And I've been doing work with the local Community Justice Center here in Bellows Falls, and it is just shocking to me how dedicated the criminal justice system is to sabotaging people who are on parole, catching them in technical violations, and sending them back to prison when they really haven't done anything to harm anybody, and they haven't really done anything to demonstrate that they're not making a sincere, good faith effort to be productive members of society. You know, I kind of hate that phrase, productive members of society, because particularly in hard economic times, not everybody is going to be generating economic activity. And the amount of economic activity that you as an individual generate is not the measure of your worth as a person. And I think that the phrase productive member of society denies that fact. And it is a moral fact. Okay, so rather than sit here and preach a sermon at you, I'll do what I normally do at the top of the hour, and that's share a couple of public service announcements. We're going
to start. You're listening to the Sea Realm podcast with your host, KMO.
That was the Lieutenant Governor of Vermont, David Zuckerman. I voted for him today. I sincerely hope that he wins. All right, next up, two interviews that I recorded at Politicon. That's the unconventional political convention. It was held in Los Angeles, and I've been back from there for a couple of weeks now, but there is plenty of material that I recorded there that I have not shared with you. Almost all of it can be found on YouTube, not on my YouTube channel, but on the YouTube channel for the Center for Progressive Urban Politics, otherwise known as CFPUP, or CFPUP. So the first interview that I'm going to share with you is with Joshua D. Glosson. He is a writer for 71 Republic, and he is, as you will hear, a libertarian. After that, the first part of a conversation anyway, with Steve Lamb. All right, here is Joshua D. Glosson. Here we are at Politicon 2018, and I'm talking with Joshua D. Glosson, who is dressed in a way that I've heard described just moments ago as Edwardian drag.
That's right, yeah, Edwardian drag. I wouldn't necessarily use the word drag. I think that I look pretty masculine in this, so I wouldn't use that word, but I know what he means, yes.
So you caught my eye. You were taking a selfie in front of the giant Trump baby.
Yes, sir. Yeah, I was definitely getting some good pictures of this event. I think it's an excellent event. That's you know, as far as the Trump blimp is concerned, I thought it was very funny and well done. Good taste.
You thought it was in good taste?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's in good taste because you know, it's a funny mockery, I would say. I tend to make fun of every president, so yeah.
Very good. And you described yourself as a libertarian.
Yes, sir. Yep, I'm a libertarian. I'm also a writer and speaker. I've been the former vice chair of the Libertarian Party of Pasadena. I worked closely with the former state chair, Ted Brown. I have worked on editing various libertarian books. And I'm pretty active.
So you're the third person that I've asked to sit down here, and you are the second libertarian out of three.
Awesome.
Yeah, and I wasn't seeking them out. I didn't know you were a libertarian until you sat down here at the mic. Libertarians don't get 2/3 of the vote.
No, unfortunately, not yet. We were looking for gaining our 5% nationally in the last election. Unfortunately, I believe we eclipsed at 4.8. So, yeah.
You know, I told you that I voted for Gary Johnson.
Yeah.
For that, I voted for Harry Brown twice.
Oh, nice. Yeah,
yeah. Voted for Michael Bednarik.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Man.
How many people remember Michael Bednarik?
You're doing a lot of good things. Yeah.
Well, it hasn't really done a whole lot, but it's a gesture. You know?
No, it's a gesture, and you're definitely putting your voice in there. And I think that, you know, I used to work in statistics with Nielsen TV ratings, and I can tell you, I think the same works in elections in the sense that the more people that actually put their vote out for the type of candidates they're looking for and the ideologies they're looking for, I believe that the system will start to measure those changes and be able to possibly start making changes on their end of the political spectrum as well.
Now, part of the libertarian platform, the last time I looked at it anyway, was basically calling for open borders.
Mm-hmm.
Do you agree with that?
Well, I will take, more of a conservative approach to that in the sense that I don't think that you can do it whenever you have a state of war or a welfare state.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't advocate for open borders 100% yet at this time. I do think ideologically in the future that's a great goal to look forward to. But I don't think that you could just open the borders now.
So if a libertarian agenda were mm-hmm. to be ascendant in the United States, you couldn't do the open borders first. That
That's
would be
right.
disastrous. What would be the order of changes?
Yeah, you definitely need to end our globalism and our part in the UN, which and also NAFTA, which sort of forces us to police the world. Hey, but you know, as far as the steps are concerned, you know, there's a lot of different things that we as libertarians want to do to help change our world and our country. As far as the main things are concerned, I would definitely say ending the war on drugs. That's definitely our first step, decriminalizing drugs. I would also say that ending our foreign body, our presence throughout the world, policing the world, that's going to be a great thing to get people, our men and women back home who are serving this country and serving the world. I'd like to see them home, and I would also like to see a gradual discontinuation of the welfare state. And I think once you've completed those things, and you have policing the police, making sure that the police are, not killing people and doing illegal activities and not getting punished for it, then I think we can have more of a just system, and we can allow people to free flow in and out of our country.
Do you live here in Los Angeles?
No, I don't. I live in Newport Beach, actually.
But you're familiar with the area.
Yes, sir. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm from Vermont.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Okay.
And
Bernie Sanders.
We were driving around last night, and I got to see Skid Row.
You
know, with my eyes.
Yep.
I'd seen images of it before, but mm-hmm. it just goes on and on.
Yeah.
And it's pretty close to a really swank area in downtown.
Yeah.
And the contrast is really stark.
Yeah.
What's a libertarian prescription for that problem?
Sure. Well, actually, 80% of homelessness is plagued by mental illness. So the problem is there's a lot of organizations out there who are willing and able to help, such as Doctors Without Borders. However, this organization's not able to practice to their full function in the United States because of various health laws and regulations that are created by, the FDA and other medical entities, medical bodies and government. So I would say that the best thing to do is to start to deregulate these organizations that are preventing nonprofit charities and churches and organizations who want to help people, genuinely help people, get back to a state of normalcy in their mental condition. I don't think that everybody wants to be homeless. I don't think that. I think that they're just not capable of seeing their hardship. Not everybody. I'm not saying everyone. I'm just saying that big section of mental illness in the homeless population. So I would say that's a first step.
So, Joshua, you describe yourself as a writer.
Yes.
Tell me about your writing.
Yeah, I mostly write for 71 Republic, which is an organization primarily for libertarians. It is named after 1971, the year that the Libertarian Party started, with John Hosper was running as president, who was, by the way, the first openly gay man to run for president. That was 1971. And then the Republic, I'm not sure why they did that. I've asked Matthew Geiger, who's the head of the organization, why. And he said, just sounded good. That's it. So, but we do allow other ideas on the site, such as communists and socialists and Republicans and Democrats and the variants of all.
I've heard that the left-right spectrum is really a ring, and if you go that's in either right. one, either direction far enough, you meet at the other side.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so the world's smallest political quiz, created by the Advocates, mm-hmm. I believe, is the organization.
A two-axis quiz.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, it's hard to determine where someone sits if you just put it on a left and right continuum. You know, I'd say the circle is a much better fit for that.
And is there any website or organization that you'd like to bring to people's attention?
Yes, I would definitely like to recommend 71republic.com. I would definitely recommend taking a look more at libertarian ideology, such as libertarianism.org. You can do various searches on there on different topics, which I believe libertarianism.org is ran by the Cato Institute. So those are great organizations to check out.
All right. Well, Joshua D. Glosson, it was great talking to you.
Thanks. Yeah, you too, man. Thank you so much for having me. I'll see you around.
We are at Politicon 2018. I'm KMO, and I'm here with Steve Lamb, who has got a story to tell that might get him in trouble in some circles. It's a story that he told me earlier today over coffee, and it involves Islam.
Well, you know, most of my life gets me in trouble if I tell the truth about it.
Uh-huh. And you don't shy away from that?
No. For a long time, I was a political activist locally in the town that I grew up in Altadena.
Mm-hmm.
And our state senator at one time had a woman who was Muslim. And she, offended all...
Now, when you say he had a woman...
She, yeah, had a woman.
In what respect did he have this woman?
Oh, I'm sorry. She worked in the office. She was a representative in the office.
Right.
Okay. So she was, in the field office for the state senator, and she was a representative for the state senator to the community. And the state senator at that time had two other people in her office who represented her to the community, and those two people were longtime friends of mine. And they were always complaining about this one particular employee who was pushing the Muslim agenda. And I knew both these women, and I knew that they were church women,
mm-hmm.
and one of them was black and very Baptist and very traditional. So I thought, she's probably a Muslim, and they're just pissed off because she's got her hair covered, right? So I go to the office one day of my state senator, and there's a counter where you sign in,
mm-hmm.
and the counter is just full of all sorts of Muslim magazines and informational material, and I go, well, shit, if they were doing that for the evangelical Christians or the Jews or the Buddhists or someone, that just wouldn't happen. So I thought, well, that's kind of strange.
That's kind of agenda pushy.
Yeah. I can see why maybe they're a little bit uptight about that. And so then a few months later, I meet this person for coffee, and we're discussing local political issues. And she looks at me and she goes, Steve, can I ask you a question? I go, sure. And she goes, well, every political person I've met with in Pasadena has made a point of telling me how much they respect the religion of Islam and our prophet. And you've never said that to me. I go, well, no. I never have. And I'll give you the Cliff Notes version of that. The Cliff Notes version of that, I respect your right to have whatever religion you want. I respect the fact that you believe it. I said, but your prophet was a slave-owning, pedophilic, insane asshole. And I have no respect at all for your religion. It belongs in the dung heap of history. It's satanic and it's evil. And she was kind of stunned. And she goes, well, you're the first honest Pasadenan I've met. And she goes, yeah. So that was, she goes, but you know, you don't even like pretend to like bow before. And I go, I don't bow before anything. I mean, you know, it's not my style.
Right. So did you have any fallout to deal with from that?
No. I mean, she and I were very, very friendly. I worked very hard to break down all sort of like appropriate barriers of appropriateness with her. You know, like I would touch her head scarf and say, cute scarf today. And I was always messing with her, but very nicely and kind of like in a brotherly kind of way. And so she knew that, I think she really knew that I didn't have like any evil intent towards her as a person specifically, mm-hmm. but just that I thought that her religion was a big pile of shit.
So you do not mouth the common wisdom that Islam is a religion of peace.
Well, Muhammad didn't believe that. Why should I?
Right.
I mean, you know, he just basically, he's very straight up in the surahs about go out, conquer, and annihilate all the non-believers. I mean,
or tax the hell out of them.
Well, if you reduce them to demi-status and basically make them slaves, you know, humiliate them throughout their entire lives. I mean, that's not peace. You know, convert by the sword or die, that's not peace. At the end of time, before the Mahdi can come and return and rule the world in a beautiful Muslim caliphate, we're going to kill all the Christians and the Jews and the Buddhists and the atheists. That's not peace. Islam is just like the worst thing in the world. And there was a reason that Tom Jefferson and the rest of the founding fathers didn't want Islam in this country. And that's because it's incompatible with the separation of church and state.
I've heard it argued, and this is, I think, probably Sam Harris that I'm channeling here, that Islam, if you have an Islamic minority in your country, they tend to be pretty well behaved. When you cross a certain threshold in terms of percentage of the population, they start to make demands, you know, that their religion be respected in civic government.
Right.
Is that a concern that you hold?
I don't think anybody's religion should be respected in civil government. I mean, I don't believe in praying before government meetings. And I mean, I'm a religious person myself. But I don't want to mix the realm of Lucifer with the sacred. And I don't want to confuse people into thinking that something as evil as political government can in any way have the sanction of Yahweh, because it absolutely does not.
So, the political realm, the social realm, is satanic. Is it a necessary evil?
Yeah, it's probably a necessary evil because people repeatedly have proven that they're incapable of governing themselves. But, you know, our political system is just rife with corruption. And I would not want to dishonor God with the illusion that he approves of that.
All right. If I may keep you on the line for just a minute longer,
okay.
We were talking about the general topic of conspiracy, and you chastened somebody for using the phrase conspiracy theory.
Yeah.
Take it from there.
Well, you know, you can use the phrase conspiracy theory, and conspiracy theory is...
I don't, usually, because I consider it to be a thought stopper.
Right. Conspiracy theory is someone who is thinking about what conspiracy may exist. I'm a conspiracy historian. I like to go look and find the documents and find what various people have done while acting together covertly to achieve some goal. Every political campaign is a conspiracy. Everybody acts covertly, overtly, but also covertly, in order to win their political campaign. So when a politician like looks at you and points and says, oh, you're a conspiracy theorist, well, dude, you have your job as a result of a conspiracy. Every state on earth, every state department on earth, acts in covert methods to achieve their political aims and their economic aims. So, you know, to live under the illusion that there are no conspiracies that every government acts out in the open is just foolishness, because we know it's not true. It's not the nature of the thing itself. The nature of the thing itself is to act in covert manner.
On the Sea Realm podcast, a mind that is stretched by a new experience can never go back, to its old dimensions.
That was Steve Lamb, and I'm not really sure what to say about Steve in order to give him a proper bio or introduction or summation. He is somebody that I met through Kevin Lynn of the Center for Progressive Urban Politics, and he was there at our booth. And like me, he was also recording interviews there at the Center for Progressive Urban Politics booth at Politicon. So you can watch those interviews and listen to them on YouTube. All right, we've come to pretty much the end of this episode of the Sea Realm podcast. There are a couple of thoughts that I want to share with you, not necessarily my thoughts. The first is from a political commentator whom I follow very casually on Twitter, and occasionally I read the pieces that she posts on Medium.com. Her name is Caitlin Johnstone, and her Medium bio describes her as rogue journalist, bogan socialist, anarcho-psychonaut, guerrilla poet, and utopia prepper. And I'm going to read just the first couple of paragraphs from a Medium piece that she posted the day before yesterday, November 4th, 2018. The title is, "If U.S. Politics Were Real, a Massive Blue Wave Would Be 100% Certain." And the photograph paired with the article is that of Donald Trump inside a pro wrestling ring with another guy in a suit and two hulking, muscly dudes. Caitlin Johnstone writes, "I haven't been writing about the U.S. midterms much because I don't care about that nonsense anymore. The whole thing's a fake pro-wrestling performance, staged every couple of years to give a heavily armed populace the illusory sense that they have some degree of control over the things their government does. By this, I do not mean that the votes aren't real or that the outcomes are predetermined. I simply mean that both mainstream parties are controlled by plutocrats who benefit from the status quo and are only interested in their own power and profit. No matter who wins on Tuesday, the wars are guaranteed to continue. The oligarchs are guaranteed to keep siphoning more and more money out of the pockets of ordinary Americans. Opaque and unaccountable intelligence agencies are guaranteed to continue expanding intrusive surveillance practices and narrative control psyops in collaboration with powerful Silicon Valley corporations. And we're guaranteed to keep hurtling toward climate catastrophe on the back of an economic system which requires infinite growth on a finite planet. The only thing that might change, a tiny bit, is America, maybe, temporarily having a government which pretends to care about oppressed minorities. Sometimes." So I won't continue further, but I read that bit because it's a nice intro to something that I read in a book. Actually, I didn't read the book. I listened to it. I got it on Audible, but it is the most recent nonfiction book, not that he writes fiction, by Yuval Noah Harari, who is best known for writing a book called Sapiens. His newest book is called 21 Lessons for the 21st Century. And I have listened to the entire book, and I'm now on my second listen through. And I'm thinking about buying the book so that when I come across a passage that I really want to remember, I can go find it in the book and highlight it. But I was listening as I walked home this morning after voting, and in the section that I was listening to, Yuval Noah Harari basically said that liberal democracy is the practice that emerged from the transfer of authority from gods to the illusory free will of free citizens. Elections are always referendums on what people feel. What people think about policy or what policies should be enacted is really rather irrelevant to the way elections are conducted, and that is as it should be, because the policy decisions based on thought and analysis should be based on the thought and analysis of people who are qualified to do that thinking and make those analyses. The examples he gave were the absurdity of holding a public plebiscite to determine whether or not Einstein got his math right, or the passengers on an airplane taking a vote on which runway the pilot will land on. These are not issues that most people are knowledgeable on, and it doesn't really matter what most people think should be done with regard to these topics. These are decisions which should be made by qualified experts. And so, this isn't from his book, but this is the thought that listening to that part of the book sparked in me, and that is that a successful democracy is one that gives the population the illusion that they are participating in the decisions made by their government, when in fact, not only do citizens not get a say, they absolutely should not get a say in most of the decisions that have to be taken by governments at almost any level. For me, the problem of governance of a technological civilization, a global technological civilization, is not that there isn't enough democracy. It's that the technocratic systems which manage our world, and by world I don't mean the planet, technocratic systems don't govern the operations of the biosphere. They don't run the planet. But by world, I mean the world in which we live. The world of words and ideas and images and groups of people forming themselves into tribes which sometimes cooperate with other tribes and sometimes compete with those other tribes and, in the 21st century, do both things simultaneously. That's the world that most people are talking about when they talk about the end of the world. The planet will be here. But if technological civilization is no longer viable, if it has been reduced to a much lower level of complexity, well, then the world that you and I inhabit, the world of podcasts, the world of Twitter, the world of Facebook, the world of YouTube, that world will have ended. But the problem with our world, the world in which we live, in my opinion, is not a lack of democracy. It's not the fact that democracy is a fake system meant to give people a sense of agency. I think that's democracy working properly. The problem, I think, is the economic system. And one thing the rise of China has definitely shown us is that democracy and capitalism are not the same thing. That you can have capitalism without democracy. And in fact, democracy and capitalism are in many senses antagonistic and somewhat contrary to one another in their imperatives. So in the book, 21 Lessons for the 21st Century, the author, Yuval Noah Harari, talks about how in the past, legitimacy was considered to be something bestowed by God, typically given from God to monarchs who ruled in God's name. And from there, political legitimacy shifted from God to the people. And the idea that the people possessed free will, and however they expressed that free will was what gave or denied legitimacy to any particular system of political power. And now he says we're shifting from that conception of legitimacy and governance to one where governance is conducted algorithmically. Which is fine if the algorithms have been well crafted. If they have not, if the algorithms have been encoded with bad ideas or directed at unsustainable aims, well, that provides us with multiple paths to dystopia. And the one that we need to take the least seriously is the one in which the machines wake up and decide that humans are the problem and decide to kill us all. Much more likely is a situation where the machines basically do their best to give us what we say we want. And it turns out that what we say we want isn't what we really want, and what we really want isn't what's good for us. Another point that Noah Yuval Harari makes in the book is that the 20th century has been a battleground in which three ideologies have slugged it out for supremacy. Those three ideologies are liberalism, fascism, and communism. He calls them stories. These are the three stories that were competing for the minds of humans over the course of the 20th century. And after World War II, fascism was basically knocked out. Then it was just a competition between two stories, liberalism and communism. Then, at the end of the 20th century, communism collapsed and we were left with just one story. That story was liberalism, and this is basically the thesis of Francis Fukuyama's book, The End of History. Some variety of liberalism will be the status quo going forward now. There's still plenty to be decided. I mean, his title was not that nothing historic would ever happen again, or that we had passed through the gates of utopia, but just that there would be no more grand narratives left to challenge liberalism. But, says Noah Yuval Harari, we've gone from that most excellent of place of there being just one guiding organizing story to now there being none because liberalism is failing. And we're left thinking, holy shit, what now? And while it may sound like his book is pretty dire, it isn't. It's hopeful. It's just a nuanced sort of hopeful. So if you go to his website, ynharari.com, you'll find 6 videos in which he is talking about the content of the book. And I'm going to play video number 6. It's just a couple of minutes long. And it is, I think, a nice antidote, which acknowledges and builds upon the things that I just summarized, but takes them a bit further into a happier place. Here's Yuval Noah Harari.
Liberalism, as we've known it, cannot survive for long, but it can certainly reinvent itself and adapt to new realities. The great advantage of liberalism over other ideologies is that it is very flexible and undogmatic. Liberalism has already experienced several cycles of crisis and regeneration over the last century. It has survived 3 big crises: the First World War, the fascist challenge in the 1930s, and the communist challenge in the 1950s to 1970s. If you think liberalism is in crisis now, just remember how things looked in 1918, in 1939, or in 1968. So there is a good chance that liberalism will again make a comeback, if it knows how to reinvent itself.
All right, that was Yuval Noah Harari, the author of 21 Lessons for the 21st Century, a book which doesn't have a colon in the title. It's just 21 Lessons for the 21st Century. I listened to the audiobook, and I'm listening to it now a second time and thinking about buying the hardcover. If you like the Sea Realm podcast, and if you don't, why are you listening to it, particularly here at the end of the episode? But if the topics that I cover on the Sea Realm podcast are of interest to you generally, then the content of this book, 21 Lessons for the 21st Century, will also be right up your alley. I highly recommend it. All right, I'm recording this on Tuesday, but I know, you know, just how podcast listening goes. Most of you won't hear it today. By the time most of you hear it, the Election Day contests will be resolved. You'll know who won. You'll know if power has shifted in the House of Representatives. I suppose it's possible it might shift in the Senate, although that seems unlikely. But this was all recorded before those contests were decided, so I can't really say anything about the outcome, at least not here on the Sea Realm podcast. I will say something about the election on the next episode of the Sea Realm Vault podcast, which is where you can also hear the end of my conversation with Steve Lamb, in which we talk about conspiracies and, in particular, 9/11. All right, that is all for this episode of the Sea Realm podcast. Thank you so much for listening. I will talk to you again pretty soon. And until I do, I hope that you will stay well.